From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how can Michigan join the ranks of prosperous states?
Places that are concentrated in knowledge-based services are the places with the highest per capita income and also experiencing the greatest job growth.
A story from Failure Lab, this time from a West Michigan beauty queen.
For someone who is constantly trying to strive for success in their personal, professional, and spiritual life, failure can create an identity crisis. Who am I when I am not succeeding?
Plus, ideas for your Thanksgiving feast from Michigan food writer Maureen Aboud.
It's a day when we throw some caution to the wind and we use good butter, a little bit of sugar, a little brown sugar, some corn syrup. It's okay on Thanksgiving.
Those stories and more. Karen Weaver began the year as a Flint businesswoman. She'll end it as the city's mayor.
They voted for a new leader, so let me lead.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, Flint's new mayor talks about the call for total local control. But first, how well is Michigan making the transition from a roll-up-your-sleeves manufacturing economy to a knowledge-based service economy? A transition that's well underway in more prosperous states. Lou Glazier of the think tank Michigan Future Inc. is here with the verdict. Welcome back, Lou.
Great to be here.
You joined with University of Michigan economist Don Grimes, with whom we've spoken often on Stateside, in studying Michigan's struggle back to economic prosperity. And according to your study, both wages and employment in Michigan are down by 2% since 2007, where the national percentages have gone up by 1% since then. So what do you think is happening in Michigan that's making it the exception?
I think, you know, you did the introduction about sort of this transition to a knowledge-based economy or to knowledge-based services. I think it's worth sort of letting people know why that matters. And why it matters is that places that are concentrated in knowledge-based services are the places with the highest per capita income and also experiencing the greatest job growth. So it's not just sort of some theoretical thing. It's what matters most now. So because of globalization and technology, prosperity now is connected to knowledge-based services, not to manufacturing. And that's the change that we're struggling with. Mm-hmm. So the data in 2007 matters because it's the year before the Great Recession started.
So kind of the last hurrah?
It's the last time we had a good economy. So what we want to look at is sort of structural changes in the economy, mm-hmm. not cyclical changes in the economy. So by looking at 07 compared to 2014, you're able to look at strong economy to strong economy, apples to apples. And what happened over that period of time is that sort of Michigan has been growing slower than the country in terms of both jobs and wages.
And when we talk about this knowledge-based service economy, right. For instance, what does that look like? What kind of jobs are those?
It's much broader than people think. I mean, we keep running into this definition of the new economy as being high tech. It's much broader than that. So it is healthcare, education, finance and insurance, professional services, which is law firms, engineering firms, architecture firms, on and on, corporate headquarters, and then this sector that's now called information, which is old and new media, telecommunications, and software. It's more than 40% of all the jobs in the country, but most importantly, because it's now the high-wage sector of the economy, it's 55% of all the wages in America. And it's the only part of the economy that from 07 to 14 both added jobs and saw wage growth. Not concentrating that part of the economy, you're going to be poorer. That's Michigan's problem.
Yeah, and you're looking at numbers. You're
right.
Looking at
data.
You know, how data. So it isn't your opinion.
Nope.
It is not. This is how I wish it would be. It's
correct.
Here's what's working elsewhere. Your report recommends that Michigan put more people to work,
right.
And concentrate more people with 4-year degrees in cities.
Right.
How do we do that?
I think the two are connected. So the growing part of the economy are services, period. Goods producing, which is manufacturing, construction, and natural resources, which is largely farming and mining, are a declining part of the economy. So services are what's growing. That's not because of politics. It's because of globalization and technology. So politicians of either party that promises more goods producing jobs structurally you know, over sort of the economic cycle, can't deliver on it. I mean, it's just not doable. So services include low education attainment services, which are things like hospitality and retail. Mm-hmm. And that's growing. And then these knowledge-based services. The way you get knowledge-based services is because the asset that matters most to them is professionals and managers who are folks with four-year degrees, is you have high concentrations of people with four-year degrees. So three things happen when you have high concentrations. The first is because they are the people with the highest wages, they create local services jobs from disposable income. The second is where they concentrate, knowledge-based service employers are attracted and move to. So we've been using this story for years about Google paying $1.9 billion for one office building in Manhattan, the same year that Dan Gilbert bought the largest office building in Detroit for $8 million. The difference between $1.9 billion and $8 million was not the building. It was access to brains. And that's why Google's in Ann Arbor. It's why Toyota's in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. Increasingly, knowledge-based employers are moving to where talent's concentrated. So that creates jobs. Mm-hmm. Third, talent, particularly young talent, is entrepreneurial. They're the people that are creating the new enterprises that are paying high wages. So, you know, when you look at the data, except for a few places that up until 2015 were prospering because of high energy prices, North Dakota being mm-hmm. sort of the major example. Except for the North Dakotas of the world, all the other places that are doing well because they have high concentrations of adults with four-year degrees and they have high knowledge-based services concentrations. So that's how you create jobs. You create jobs with talent concentrations. It's not being business friendly. It's not sort of all the stuff.
All the things that our governor's been.
Exactly. Everybody tells you. But you look at the data, so the top 10 states in employment earnings, which is the proportion of per capita income that comes from jobs. Mm-hmm. Eight of them, so you take Alaska and North Dakota out, which are the energy state, all the other eight are in the top 10 in college attainment. There is no correlation between their tax structure, between all of these business-friendly things. The thing that correlates is education attainment.
Lou, do you disagree with the governor and with President Obama with their focus on post-secondary technical and vocational training?
Somewhat. I mean, I think the point that we've been trying to make about—so there's two things. Mm-hmm. For you and I and for our kids, the best paying jobs and the people that work most are those who have four-year degrees. So we want an education system that provides that opportunity to all kids. Having said that, there are all sorts of two-year degree jobs, mm-hmm. occupational certificate jobs that pay well, and kids should have the ability to choose to go into those jobs. So there's no argument. I think the argument is when we start to say to other people's kids, don't get a four-year degree, you're better off getting a two-year degree. We want to say to kids, all kids, you have the option of doing either.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. But I think what's important is that so that's for us as individuals. Mm-hmm. For communities, having concentrations of four-year degrees is what gets you the job creation and knowledge-based services. So what's different between Michigan and Massachusetts, Michigan and Minnesota, is not the number of welders and carpenters that we have. It's the number of professionals and managers that we have. That's where the multiplier is.
Now, I'm interested in your thoughts. Or there were a lot of reader comments following the story in Bridge Magazine about your study, questioning that emphasis on four-year degrees. And the one reader called that idea that higher education is a cure-all to the economy a sad joke, pointing to the hundreds of IT workers at that California utility and at Disney who were replaced by overseas workers holding H-1B visas, and they actually had to train their replacements before they shuffled out the door. The question is, who's to say that trend won't spread to other employers and other sectors of the economy?
It will. So let's first deal with how it affects individual workers. There are no guarantees. The fact that you've got a degree doesn't give you a guarantee. What a four-year degree does is two things. One, it is the best insurance policy against a world in which jobs and occupations are constantly being changed. So what has ended up happening is the people who have four-year degrees lose jobs. have the skill base that allows them to get the next job much better than anybody else. So that's number one. Number two, for the community, which is really what this study is all mm-hmm. about, it's about how the state can do better and how metropolitan areas can do better. The goal is to be concentrated in knowledge-based services, not to have lots. So the four-year degree is not the goal. The four-year degree is an input into getting knowledge-based services. And the reason you want knowledge-based services is that's where jobs are growing the quickest and where the wages are the highest. So professionals and managers in the 21st century economy have replaced factory workers in the 20th century economy as the mass middle class.
Any good news for Michigan? Any encouraging news in your study, do you think?
Yeah. So certainly the job growth is, mm-hmm. you know, Grimes and I have been studying Michigan 20 years, but for the last 10, from 2000 to 2010, we're studying a state that had been losing jobs every year. We're starting to gain jobs again, actually quicker than the nation. So that's very good news. Too many of them are the lower wage jobs, but at least we're getting jobs. The second good news is the state of Michigan, Metro Detroit, and Metro Grand Rapids all have a higher proportion of 25 to 34-year-olds with college degrees than those 35 and older. So our college attainment is improving, which is a good thing both for them and for the economy.
Luke Laser is the president of Michigan Future Inc., a think tank based in Ann Arbor, with the results of the latest report. It's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
It is time to vote. Our Am I Curious project is powered by you. You submit the questions, we put them up for a vote, and then we'll investigate the winning decision together. Just go to MichiganRadio.org and find the box that says, which question should we investigate next? Our next story could be about the last streetcar on Gratiot, the story behind Detroit's Masonic Temple, or a question about a time capsule. It's all up to you. Just go to MichiganRadio.org and cast your vote. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Thanksgiving feast is at hand, just 2 days away. Perhaps like me, you're a guest this year, and you're wondering what dish you can bring because you don't want to show up empty-handed, and you do want to bring something wonderful. Well, we decided to turn to East Lansing food writer Maureen Aboud. We last spoke with Maureen about her book, Rosewater and Orange Blossoms, Fresh and Classic Recipes from My Lebanese Kitchen. Hi, Maureen.
Hello.
Always wonderful to talk food with you. I'm wondering, where does the Thanksgiving dinner rank for you in the pantheon of holiday meals?
Oh, really high. Really high, because the focus is so much on food for Thanksgiving, and the flavors are so delicious and rich, and we get to splurge that day. So I really love the Thanksgiving meal.
I noticed
the feast.
It is a feast, and I noticed in your blog you think that sweet and fat are the things that make that Thanksgiving dinner plate so marvelous.
They really are. I think it's a day when we throw some caution to the wind and we use good butter and we aren't too afraid to use a little bit of sugar, a little brown sugar, some corn syrup. It's okay on Thanksgiving.
Now, you tend to, I get the feeling from reading your blog, you tend to go to Thanksgiving dinner as a guest. What, you go to your mom's?
My mom's and my mother-in-law's. Mm. So I have two big feasts that I get to enjoy and they both go all out. So I like to ask if I could bring something small, and sometimes they let me.
Well, you write in your blog, Rosewater and Orange Blossoms, that over the years, you've watched your mom knock out wonderful candied sweet potatoes, but you have kind of had your challenges trying to recreate that?
Oh, her sweet potatoes are the best. They're like a lacquered, shiny, glistening, beautiful platter of sweet potatoes that are candied with her own brown sugar, butter, syrup. And I didn't think that it would be so difficult to make on my own, but a couple of years ago when I was cooking them for my own Thanksgiving dinner, they didn't turn out so well. They were mushy. The syrup wasn't as good as hers by a long shot. So I decided to keep a distance, let her make them her way, and I'll enjoy them. And then I can come up with other things, like my own sweet potato recipe.
Yeah, so that's the first dish you want to share with us. What is your version of this sweet potato dish?
I keep it really simple by roasting, and I love to roast vegetables because they get a wonderful browning on the exterior, soft and delicious on the interior. And with sweet potatoes, you don't even have to peel them. You can if you don't like the skin on them, but just cut them into wedges. Toss them with a wonderful mix of olive oil, a little bit of honey to bring out the sweetness, and some of my favorite spices. One of those is sumac, which is a Lebanese spice. It's bright red, and it has a real citrusy sort of tang to it. That combined with the sweetness of the sweet potato and maybe a little hit of cayenne pepper, and it is a winner. Toss the wedges in this sauce and then put them on a hot sheet pan that you've heated as the oven was heating, real high, to about 500. You know, when you do that and then you put whatever vegetable it is, and in this case the sweet potatoes, across that hot sheet pan, they start to get their nice, crisp, and browned exterior right away.
What a good tip, because I know when I've roasted potatoes in the past, I'll do all the tossing and get them all coated, but I put them on the sheet pan and then put them in. I'm not preheating that pan. What a great tip.
It's a great one, and you can use it on so many different types of roasted dishes.
Now, where do we buy sumac?
You can find sumac at most international grocery stores. They carry sumac. Look for the bright red. Ask if it's fresh. And it will last you a while. You know, you can buy it in big bags at some of the Middle Eastern markets because we use it in many of our dishes. So they all carry it.
So sumac roasted sweet potatoes is the first suggestion. Your next suggestion kind of gives a contrast, doesn't it, to the rich foods at the Thanksgiving dinner.
Absolutely. I wouldn't have that meal without a nice, fresh, crisp salad with a lemony vinaigrette on it. As you're eating, it gives you a little break in the action, and it's really a welcome way. It's almost like pairing wine with dinner for me because it allows the other flavors to really be enjoyed and to stand out so that not every bite you're taking is the sweet, sugary, salty, fatty, you know, bite. The salad that I love is another Lebanese-style salad, which is a fattoush salad. Also, you can use sumac in this for the dressing, a little pomegranate molasses, which has a sweetness to it. But the lemon in particular, a lemon vinaigrette on a crisp romaine salad with lots of other veggies in there, radish, cucumber, red onion. It's just wonderful. And classically, fattoush has toasted pita chips in it, which I love. It gives it crunch, texture. You can leave them out if you feel you're already carved out, but but I like them in the salad. It's a nice crunch with the lettuce.
And of course, you don't let us down. You offer up a dessert, and you say in your blog you're going to make at least four pies. Which one do you want to share with us today?
I have to have. Absolutely have to have my chocolate caramel pecan tart on Thanksgiving. It's a must because it is special and delicious. And the tart is a little bit different than a pie in that it's in a pan with a fluted edge and a removable bottom. And my crust recipe, you don't have to use a rolling pin, which I think a lot of people like. You can dispense with that. And it's called a push-in crust. So you take the dough and you just push it into the tart pan. And then you bake that off, and you add this wonderfully chocolatey sauce in the middle, which has toasted pecans in it. And then it's topped again with another dark chocolate sauce over the top.
Okay, everybody here is drooling. That sounds great. And it doesn't sound scary hard. I think a lot of us, when we hear a pie, we go, you've got to,
yes.
You know, cutting in ice water and cutting it right and rolling it out and ways to murder a pie.
It's true. And it can be tricky with the traditional butter crust. It can be a little bit tricky. What I like about my crust is you can do it in your food processor, add an egg to the mix and some almonds, and that gives that dough some body and it makes it a lot easier to work with.
This tart actually got you started in food writing?
I like to think so because I had this tart when I was living in Chicago at one of my favorite French bistro restaurants. And I thought, I am going to get this recipe. And I wrote into Bon Appetit magazine, which has a department, RSVP, where they'll write into a restaurant and ask for the recipe that you request. Well, Bon Appetit requested the recipe from this restaurant, and they got it, and they published it. With my letter saying, this is my favorite dessert, and my family enjoys it at this restaurant whenever they come to visit. And so I felt like, okay, that's my first published piece of food writing.
Well, so just to recap, we have talked about beautiful sumac roasted sweet potatoes, which honestly sounds great all year round because I'm a big sweet potato nut, Lebanese fattoush salad, and chocolate caramel pecan tart. You can find the recipes at maureenabood.com, which is where you'll want to follow her wonderful food blog, Rosewater and Orange Blossoms. You've got us all hungry, Maureen, and that's perfect. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving feast.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
For someone who is constantly trying to strive for success in their personal, professional, and spiritual life, failure can create an identity crisis. Who am I when I am not succeeding?
And now, a story from Failure Lab from Jody Beckman, Miss West Michigan 2015.
On your mark, get set, go. Six words. Six words that mean one thing to me: winning. I have always been someone who is striving to succeed. I want to be the best possible Jody that I can be. I want to push the limits. I have always been someone who's striving. And when I am succeeding and when I am on top of that mountain, I kind of feel like Rocky when he's going up the steps, pumping his fist. But everybody knows that life is not just mountains. There's a lot of valleys. And when I am in one of those valley moments, I feel my biggest fear seeping into my being: failure. For someone who is constantly trying to strive for success in their personal, professional, and spiritual life, failure can create an identity crisis. Who am I when I am not succeeding? Something about me is I also grew up in a very, very competitive family. I'm the oldest of five kids, and it's still not uncommon this day to see balls flying through the air and games being played. Something that we love to do together is basketball. We talk about basketball. We used to travel around, and we still travel around to games and tournaments. And growing up, every night before I went to bed, I would go to the barn and shoot 100 shots. And every night, I had to end on a swoosh. Basketball was something that I was very good at. It was a gift. And basketball is something that I loved because there was strategy, there was a team component, and there was a rush about winning. I was also had the privilege of being on my varsity team for 4 years, and I grew up dreaming about playing college basketball. And naturally, my dad played basketball at Hope, so Hope College seemed like the right fit for me. But what I wasn't expecting at that time was that in one of my last games of my regular season, my senior year, I went up for a rebound and I came down on another girl's foot. And when I did that, my knee slid sideways and I dropped. For someone who only played basketball, I didn't expect to have to sit out. This was the first time that I was being restricted from playing, so all I could do was think. And as I was thinking, you know, I was reflecting on, you know, the past experiences where I have improved, but I also started thinking about the future. You know, what was my life as a player at Hope College going to look like? Was I going to be successful? And the more I thought about it, the more that I had doubts about my ability. But being the winner that I was, I, you know, beat that injury. I finished the season strong. My team didn't finish the season strong, but I recovered. And I started preparing for my college career. But a few weeks before school started, I contacted Coach Mo and told him that I was hanging up my basketball shoes. This was one of the hardest days of my life because I knew that I was disappointing everybody. I was disappointing my parents. I was disappointing my siblings. I was disappointing my community. What was a girl that was just known as Miss Basketball going to do? What I kept hearing from people was, Jody, you're giving up your gift. And for me, what I mentally was saying, and I have never said out loud until tonight, is that I didn't want to fail. It was easier to give up and to end as a winner. So I walked away. And I started going to Hope College, and I loved it. I loved the campus life. I was an RA. I was an RA of Gilmore Hall. Any Gilmore girls out here? Woo! And, you know, I enjoyed campus ministry, and I was on intramurals. You know, I loved life. Then the summer going into my junior year at Hope, so July 2012, I was working at a church camp in Montana. And while I was there, I was hanging out with the little kids, and I started to get dizzy. I grabbed the counter, I passed out, I hit my head on the counter, and then on the cement floor. I blacked out. So naturally, when somebody blacks out, everybody, you know, runs around and tries to wake you up. And so I woke up to a bunch of strangers all, you know, trying to ask if I was okay. So they rushed me to the hospital. And for some reason, when I was at the hospital, I filled out on my forms that I was married, even though I wasn't married. So that really caused a lot of confusion. And I didn't just circle the word married. I actually wrote out the word married. So that was even worse. So naturally, they said that I had a mild concussion. So it made sense. So basically, what they said at that time was, you know, wake her up in the middle of the night and make sure she's conscious. Seemed easy enough. So I went back to camp, finished off the week, and then I flew home. I thought life was good. But then the struggles happened. I would wake up in the morning and have several very difficult migraines. And these migraines would cause me to be very ill, and I would throw up multiple times a day. I also started seeing that I was having problems with my reading vision. I could read something for about 3 minutes, and after those 3 minutes, everything got blurry, which caused migraines, which caused me to get sick. My mom started noticing that I was really struggling with my memory. And no, it was not selective memory, because I think my dad has that, but, you know, but that was also something I was struggling with. And I also was struggling with my perception. I couldn't see 3D images, and I would run into doorways and trip down stairs. I was really struggling. So naturally, I went to my doctor, and my doctor recommended that I go to Mary Freebed, which is a brain and spine rehabilitation center in Grand Rapids. And while I was there, I met with a neurologist, and I started doing a lot of testing. And when I was doing that testing, you know, they're giving me very, very simple tasks, such as, you know, remember five figures. So they would give me stars and basketballs and blueberries and teepees and a chair, and they would give me random figures, and I had to remember what they were. After 5 minutes, they would ask me what I remembered, and I couldn't ever remember what it was. Then they would give me a piece of paper, and on the piece of paper, it would have a whole bunch of patterns of different figures, and they would say, okay, find the dogs on that sheet. And I could never find the dogs. So, being the winner that I was going to overcome this, and I was going to go back to school. So I attempted it. Even though I was at a kindergarten learning level based on the problems that I couldn't do, I was still going to try. So I went for a week, and it was an epic fail. I was very overwhelmed. Everything was overstimulating, conversation, lights. You know, I couldn't sit in on a lecture with a professor talking because I couldn't comprehend what he was saying in time to write my notes down. I couldn't do life. So I raised my hands up, and I packed my stuff and moved home. I was just doing therapy every single day. This was a time in my life where I hated who I was. Everything that I had strived for, everything that I thought that I had succeeded at in the past was gone. Friends, education, you know, I was a very active individual. All of it was gone. But what hurt the most was I remember one day that I was laying on the ground in my room and I was just crying. And I was crying to God asking, you know, why can't I do my one purpose in life? And my one purpose that I've always felt that I have is, why can't I use the gifts and abilities that I have been given to further your kingdom? And I was angry, I was frustrated that I couldn't do that one thing. But at that time, it was also an aha moment. Because what I viewed as successful was using my gifts and my abilities. So let's flash back to the basketball situation. When my friends and my family were saying, you're not using your gift. Jody, why aren't you using this gift? And what I mentally was saying was, I don't want to fail. But apparently it took a brain injury to find clarity that what I was doing was already failing. I was not using the God-given gifts and abilities that I was blessed with. My biggest failure in life is not using the God-given gifts and abilities that I have been blessed with. So what I challenge you to do tonight is think about and tweet about the God-given gifts and abilities that you are not using.
That was Jody Beckman, Miss West Michigan 2015, telling her story of failure. We'll hear more of these stories on Stateside from our partners at Failure Lab. And you can find out more and listen to more stories by going to failure-lab.com. Still to come, why Michigan dairy producers are literally dumping milk down the drain. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Flint is certainly beset by many challenges and problems, which means the city's newly elected mayor has not had the luxury of gradually learning the ropes. Karen Weaver ousted incumbent Mayor Dane Walling this month, making her the first woman to hold the office of mayor of Flint. Mayor Karen Weaver, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Let's plunge right in. Mayor Weaver, water was certainly one of your most crucial campaign issues. And as part of your 100-day plan, you've said that you want to press to get Flint declared a federal disaster zone.
That's what I would like to have happen. And that's what a number of people would like to have happen, because it's a public health crisis and it's also an infrastructure crisis for the city of Flint as well. And we know the city doesn't have the funds to be able to handle this kind of disaster. We know the state doesn't have the funds, so we need some federal assistance.
And what do you think this could mean for people living in Flint if you were able to successfully push to get this proclamation?
You know, it would help us fix our water crisis, because right now what we're putting in place isn't the solution. People are using filters. That's a Band-Aid for something that we need major surgery for. It also gives people, it eases their mind to know we have the funds to be able to start taking care of the infrastructure, because if we don't address the infrastructure, then what's the point? What's the point? We know we've got to get clean, safe water to people. So that's what we're trying to do right now. But it would also mean jobs. It would mean jobs, because we'd have all of those, you know, the different infrastructure jobs that would be coming to the city as well. So it would help us there, you know, in addition to making people feel relaxed, making people feel safe, making people know that their voices have been heard, because it's all of those things wrapped up in this.
Another thing you were very clear about is that you want to return the governance of Flint, Mayor Weaver, to home rule. What in your mind would this look like, and would that help to solve the many problems that are at hand in Flint?
Well, I believe it would help to solve some of the problems that are in Flint. You know, it's always better when you can take care of yourself instead of having someone do that for you. And so we want government control back to us. You know, we want to take care of ourselves. And we're not under emergency manager anymore. We ought to be able to take care of ourselves and have our say-so in what goes on with the city. You know, one of the things we know is our charter has not changed. Our charter is a strong mayor form of government. And so that's what we should be operating under. Right now we're in violation of our city charter. And the other thing is the people voted, and they voted overwhelmingly. And so it's another way to show that they voted for change. They didn't vote for a different face to do the same thing. They voted for change, and they spoke out loud and clearly. And I'm hoping that the state is seeing that and recognizing that and trusting that they voted for a new leader, so let me lead. Let me lead.
And with that in mind, how much power do you see yourself having right now in the city of Flint?
Well, that's still to be determined. What do I believe I should have?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that I should be the leader of the city. Like I said, I believe we're in violation of the charter right now when you don't have that happening. Here's some things you can do, here's some things you can't do. That's not what our charter states. And while we have a charter review committee, nothing has been changed with our charter. And so that's what we ought to be upholding, that the mayor is the voice. You know, I was elected by the people to be the leader of the city. So, you know, I can't do that without full control.
And so where do you think you stand right now? You've got this intention of returning governance to home rule. But as we speak today, how much power do you believe you have?
Well, you know, I'm in conversation with the state, so we're going to see what happens with that.
What kind of relationship do you have right now with the state-appointed city administrator, Natasha Henderson?
I'm willing to work with Ms. Henderson. I don't have anything against her personally at all, so I want to be very clear on that. I want to work with the people that are here. I don't believe that the structure that is in place is correct. That's my issue. It's not with Ms. Henderson. Ms. Henderson and I ought to be able to work together, and that's what we've been trying to do. I mean, I've been here for just 2 weeks. So she and I are trying to work together, and there ought to be goals that are bigger than the both of us. That should be for the city of Flint that we know are important and that we should be working together to try to make happen. And so that's where I am right now. I believe that we need to be very professional and respectful of each other. I believe that we can work together and there are things that can get accomplished, but I believe that the structure that is in place is incorrect.
One of the things that Natasha Henderson has gone on the record saying is that she will not allow a top official to be dismissed without good reason, yet that's a power that's afforded to you as elected mayor according to the charter. What kind of compromise do you think you'll be able to work with her and the Transition Advisory Council over an issue as tough as this one?
Well, at this point, I'm going to wait and see if that stays in place. That's what I need to know, if that's going to be upheld or not, because, like I said, I'm in conversation, and I want to see what comes out of the conversation before I say, okay, well, this didn't happen. Here's what I'm going to do.
It is early, absolutely. And I know one of the things that has to be done is to find a replacement for Howard Croft, the former Department of Public Works director. And I'm sure I can tell from what you're saying, you expect to have input in that.
I do expect to have input in that. You're absolutely right.
Have you sat down with her, face-to-face conversations, coffee?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How's that gone?
Sure. We're working together at this point.
Fair enough. What kind
of... Yeah, we're working together. I mean, that would be detrimental to the city for us not to work together, and I don't want to have that happen.
So compromise and communication, it sounds like, is going to be the bedrock.
Well, yeah, because you always go in trying, and that would be wrong for both of us to not try.
Now, what kind of steps do you intend to take to move away from this Transition Advisory Council and, you know, get out from under the state and return to home rule?
Well, one of the things is I need to share with them, here's my vision for the city. Here's how I plan on getting things done. Here's how I plan on being fiscally responsible and letting them know this can be done. But, you know, you have to free me up to do it. You have to free me up to do it. So those are the kinds of things that I need to share with them and that we need to be looking at. And if it's a way that makes sense, I believe it is. You know, I was talking with somebody earlier where they believe Detroit couldn't be turned around, but you see what's happening. So I believe the same can happen with Flint.
And how will you know when your work in Flint has been successful? I'm wondering if you have benchmarks in your mind for success.
Well, I will have some benchmarks, and I have them in mind, and I'm trying not to get out in front of next week. Well, after Thanksgiving is when I'm going to do the 100-day agenda, so I'm trying not to get ahead of that. But one of the things that will be tied to that would be benchmarks and timelines for certain things to happen. I was asked, was everything going to happen in 100 days? Of course not. Some things will happen within that 100-day period, and others will, okay, we'll have gotten this far along in the plan or the project during that 100-day. And some of it will happen in the third quarter or the fourth quarter or the next year. But when that gets outlined, it will have benchmarks, time frames, all of that attached to it.
Well, you ran for office, you were elected, and here you are. So what has the reality been like for these first few weeks compared to what have been the surprises that you didn't expect when you were on the other side as a candidate?
Probably the biggest surprise was I believe I ought to be able to make my own appointments. And that doesn't mean doing something drastic. And, you know, sometimes people hear you say, I want to make my own appointments, and they say, oh, that means she wants to get rid of everybody. You know, people making assumptions about different things. But I believe that I ought to be able to do that. That's been the biggest surprise, and how quickly stories get spun that aren't accurate. It's like, well, where'd you get that? Where'd you hear that? Mm. And people hear all kinds of things, and you just say, wow, that's the furthest thing from my mind.
Flint Mayor Karen Weaver, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today, the first of what I'm sure will be many conversations on Stateside.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
And we would love to hear from you. Find out what stories you're focusing on or issues you want to hear more about. You can let us know very easily. Just find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and, of course, MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. When it comes to milk and dairy products, Vermont and Wisconsin may have the big national reputation and fame, But Michigan isn't far behind, ranking sixth in milk production nationwide, which is why this line from an article from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel caught our eye. I'll quote, "Earlier this year, dairies in the Northeast and Michigan dumped more than 30 million pounds of milk into waste systems, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, because the processors lacked the capacity or the markets to handle it." So does this mean that Michigan milk producers are literally dumping their product down the drain? Here now to explain what's happening is Christopher Smith, professor of agriculture, food, and resource economics at Michigan State University. Thanks so much for joining us, Chris.
Thanks, Cynthia.
I want to point out to our listeners, the stat about dumping dairy is from an article that's entitled "Farmers Fret as Milk Prices Plummet, Profits Dwindle." Can you give us an overall sense of the current state of the dairy industry in general, and especially here in Michigan?
Sure. A year ago, we were in the middle of the most profitable year for dairy farmers, at least in 25 years, and maybe one of the most profitable ones ever. And so this year has been different because we don't have the record milk prices that we had last year on the farm. Milk prices are more actually towards the average, but because of some market issues in Michigan, we've had prices a little bit lower than we would have expected because we haven't had enough processing capacity in a couple periods to handle some of the milk production.
What are these market issues?
Well, the way the dairy industry works is you can have the milk on the farm for a short period of time, but of course it's perishable, and you can't store milk in a beverage form. So there's some complications to milk marketing, which is that if you want to keep it for longer than a couple of days, you know, it's got to go in the bottle and it's got to get to the store, or else it's got to be converted to something else like cheese or butter, which is storable, but of course you can't bring it back. So the way it works is we have more milk production than we need to go in the bottle, and then the rest of it needs to be put into cheese, butter, yogurt, ice cream, non-fat dry milk, things like that. We also have the fact that the highest amount of milk production is in the spring, when it's more common to have calving and when we have fresh feed, whereas the highest amount of milk consumption, dairy consumption, is around the holidays, so that they don't match up. So what we do is put a lot of milk in the spring and summer months into cheese, butter, ice cream, things like that, and keep it for the holidays. In Michigan, what happened is we've had tremendous amount of growth. So as you pointed out, Michigan, sixth largest milk producer, actually in the last few months been the fifth largest, and if we finish the year out this way, Michigan will move into number five for milk production. And Michigan has always been a state that shipped a significant amount of milk to other places. And we have dairy co-ops that farmers are members of, and 80% of the milk goes through co-ops. And the co-ops operate processing facilities to process the milk, and they also bargain with the people that they sell the milk. But they don't have enough processing capacity to process all of the milk at any given time. And what happened in the spring and in the summer in a couple of instances is that there was no home for the milk, or in some cases they had to ship milk far enough away that the trucks couldn't make it back in time to pick up again, so that they ended up having to dump some milk. And as you pointed out, not just in Michigan, but in the Northeast as well.
That has to be heartbreaking for these farmers, you know, and they don't set the milk price, do they?
No, they don't set the milk price. The co-op helps them bargain for a milk price that's set really at a national level, and then there's local adjustments. And that's why they're members of co-op. And then if they have to dump the milk, then the co-op has to help deal with sharing the responsibility and the cost of that, too.
So why is it that so much of the United States now has too much milk?
First of all, it was such a good year last year that the market was saying produce more milk. And so dairy farmers, well, actually U.S. farmers in general, really good at responding to these market signals. And farmers in Michigan are very good managers, good at making milk, and so they expand production, new facilities going in. And once you are invested in a dairy facility, it's expensive, then you need to operate it, and you want to operate it at capacity if you're going to get a return on your investment. So we've had growth in Michigan, growth at 6-7% or more, which is twice as much as what we would expect for a growth rate. Processing facilities are big long-term investments. Frankly, it was difficult to forecast this kind of growth and have the processing facilities in place. And normally, if Wisconsin wasn't up in milk production and New York up in milk production, there would be places you could ship the milk to have it processed. But Wisconsin themselves is up 5% this last month in year-over-year milk production growth, and that's a huge amount for Wisconsin. The Wisconsin facilities are at capacity, so even if the Michigan guys, in a couple of instances, wanted to send the milk there, they had trouble finding a home for it.
So what does this mean right now for the average dairy farmer in Michigan? Is this the kind of thing that could take someone under? Are they just treading water, breaking even?
Well, some of the charges that have been incurred from this have lowered the milk price paid a little bit. But the other part of the price aspect that I didn't talk about before is that we are exporting 15% of the milk production in this country, typically in the form of processed dairy products, in particular to China and Southeast Asia. Mexico is our biggest dairy trade partner. But China has really cut back on their purchasing, and the Russian embargo has happened, and that has affected the world dairy markets. At the same time, the European Union has ended their milk production quotas, and European Union milk production has taken off. And so we kind of had a real backlog, an oversupply, if you will, of production on the world dairy markets, and that's happened at a bad time so that the U.S. exports have been cut back. That has also played part of this picture. And unfortunately, the way the market tends to work in agriculture, and in particular in dairy farming, is that if we need to produce a little bit less milk, it doesn't happen in the way that everybody cuts back a couple percent. What tends to happen is there's some structural change, and some people decide, hey, maybe now's a good time to retire. Hopefully they do so voluntarily, sometimes involuntarily, and that's the way we cut back on milk production.
When do you think, if you can look into the future and do any predicting, when might this big backlog of too much milk ease and we don't have to see farmers pouring it down the drain?
You know, that's isolated events that they've been pouring it down the drain. They're not pouring it down the drain now. Mm-hmm. It happened with a couple of events earlier. And to the best of my knowledge, there's nothing being poured down the drain or, in this case, back into the manure pit and used as nutrients back on the soil at the current time. Frankly, the market is right now putting the brakes on the incentive to expand. Partly what it depends on is what China does, what Russia does, and what the European Union does. This didn't used to be the case. 20 years ago, we could have had the same conversation, and we would have been just talking about what happens in the U.S. Hmm. Fortunately for the dairy farmers, the U.S. economy looks fairly strong, and the consumption has been strong.
Well, it certainly is it's a lesson for those of us who are not tuned into the life of a dairy farmer, the kind of pressures that are exerted on them. And, yeah, that's tough to see, but appreciate your explanation of all of this. And I guess the final question, what about consumers? Does any of this impact exactly what we might pay for a jug of milk at the store?
It does. The consumer prices tend to respond to the farm prices, but they tend to respond asymmetrically, in that they tend to increase when the farm prices increase and not necessarily decrease when the farm prices decrease. That would be historically what's happened. Prices for dairy products are actually down a little bit over what they had been the last couple of years. Certainly, I think if you talk to most of the dairy farmers, they would like to see the consumer prices come down more. And we see sales in the store and things like that, and that tends to move product. So it should be the case that we shouldn't see increases on the consumer side for dairy products, certainly.
Chris Wolf is a professor of agriculture, food, and resource economics at Michigan State University. Chris, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Brian Grimes, Sean McHenry, Mercedes Mejia, and Shelley Smith. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.